This is Dawn Walsh here conducting an interview with Judy Smith as part of the Montana Feminist History Project. We are going to be talking about the history of Women's Place and Judy's involvement in that. We are at the Swift Building, which is located 315 South 4th East, Missoula, Montana. The date is April 23rd, year 2001. So, Judy, I'd like to start off by asking you about the very beginnings of Women's Place. What were the conversations that led to the opening, and how were you involved in that?
Well, Dawn, as I mentioned to you, I had an opportunity to reflect on this over the weekend since you'd been telling me we were going to do this interview. And to some degree, I will have to start out as somewhat of a personal odyssey, and then you'll see how it weaves all of this together. But I was in Austin, Texas for my graduate work, and there I was involved in starting a birth control and abortion referral service. And at the timing of all of this, I was also involved in the Roe v. Wade abortion case. And at the end of that moment of being in Austin, I moved to Missoula, and Roe v. Wade had just been decided, so to me it was time to open an abortion clinic. So I was moving to Missoula, and I thought, you know, the answer is we will just start an abortion clinic in Missoula. So I moved here with that in mind, and I started meeting some of the women in the community here, and there was a group that was also already in existence called the Women's Health Collective. And so I went and met with a few of those folks and talked to them about what we had been doing in Austin, that we had our, you know, birth control and abortion referral service and the kinds of things we did there, and that made sense to me to have an abortion clinic. So in many ways, Women's Place became the intermediate step. It was this group of women who'd been doing some health-related education and myself coming from somewhere else with an idea and saying, let's do this thing, and realizing that we couldn't immediately start an abortion clinic, but that we would build toward that. And so in those conversations, we talked over what would be possible immediately and talked about starting this referral service. And again, my interest and background was in birth control and abortion. However, in Austin, just when I was leaving, we began to get some phone calls to our service from women who were the victims of violence. And it was one of those organic things that I think has happened throughout the feminist movement, which is you don't necessarily think you're looking for this thing, but it starts to happen, and then you go, okay, women need this. What are we going to do? So we started getting these calls from rape victims, basically, because we were a campus-based organization and service. And at first, we didn't know what to say either. I mean, you know, we had to educate ourselves about, okay, women are calling us. What shall we do? How can we help? So we educated ourselves on the laws around rape and on what you would do for rape victims. And again, the whole women's movement was just beginning to learn this. There was no standard way of handling this now. It was just becoming. And this was like, as I said, 73. So then moving up here and starting this idea of let's start a call-in place for women, and we would do birth control and abortion, but we would also do, because I knew at this time, you know, this was likely, we would put out the word that we also would take any kind of crisis calls or violence calls. And we started our service in the Y, because in Austin we had our birth control and abortion service in the Y. So I just went, oh, there's a Y, let's go talk to the Y. I didn't realize at that time that that was probably unusual for the Y to be involved in that kind of a thing, but at that, you know, who knew? So we just went and asked, and they said yes. So there was a group of us that started doing this, and we were all volunteers, and we all basically showed up for our shift, and we all did our own collective education. And the calls started coming in, and a lot of them were at first abortion calls, because, and this is where it gets kind of woven into many other things. Another thing that I did when I moved here is my partner and I, who moved up, who had both been working on abortion issues in Austin, challenged the Montana Abortion Control Act. So since we had challenged the law in Texas, we just thought, of course, you'd challenge the law in Montana. And so we got involved in that, and there was a court case. So we knew that there were no places to get abortions in Montana because it was still illegal here. And they tried to keep it illegal even after the Roe versus Wade decision with the Montana Abortion Control Act. So while we were doing this referral service, we also were challenging the law. And also I was involved in getting the Women's Resource Center started on campus. So again, all these kind of weave together, because the women who came to work at Women's Place, some of them had worked on the pro-choice abortion, you know, challenge, and some had worked at the resource center. So we had this sort of fluid group of women who were involved in this larger conversation around women's issues and particularly in this case reproduction, and then violence started to come in as one of the themes that we would be talking about there. So I was thinking back about the first training we did for Women's Place volunteers, and again, several of the women were from the Women's Resource Center, several were from the Missoula Pro-Choice organization. There was a law student who's still a friend of mine who's now a practicing attorney. You know, just various women that had been part of this grouping, and then these women that were also part of the Women's Health Collective. So this is my experience with feminist institutions. As you begin to build them, then women are drawn to them, mm-hmm. you know, and not necessarily for the particular issue, but because they want to be involved in a feminist institution of some mm-hmm. kind. So we had this group, and we did our first training, and I can remember preparing for that training. And I was, as I said, very comfortable doing the birth control and abortion part, but the whole rape crisis, and then by that time even some domestic violence issues were coming up. That was something we had to learn more about. And one of the great things that's been around is the amount of information that different parts of the women's movement have made available, so our bodies ourselves, mm-hmm. which also started out as a sexuality, birth control and abortion, also started going into the whole violence, so you could take material from what they had learned, and they were growing resources from other parts of the country that feminists were beginning to engage these issues. So in many ways, feminism for me was always a national movement, even though each local place was doing whatever it was doing, it was connected up to a lot of other places. So we could gather information from places that were already doing this work and train ourselves on how to do rape crisis intervention and those kinds of things. So we got started, we were in the Y, we started getting calls, and at first we didn't get an incredible number of calls, but it grew. And we, as I say, met other women who were interested and had some education programs in the community. We began to do different kinds of education classes, particularly through the Resource Center, but also in other parts of the community. Again, not so much just on birth control and abortion anymore, but also then picking up this whole conversation around rape and domestic violence and violence against women and what did that mean. And so the whole theoretical concept of, okay, how do you get at violence? I mean, it's not enough to just talk about this particular situation that happened to this particular woman, but how do you understand why it happens and what do you do about it? So, of course, having those conversations and trying to get that information out. And because the Women's Resource Center had a newsletter, we would write things for the Women's Resource Center newsletter. I mean, so we had this sort of, and the Women's Resource Center had annual conferences, so Women's Place would be involved in some of the annual conferences. So there was definitely what would be called now overlapping directorates, you know. Some of the same women that were involved in the Resource Center were involved at Women's Place and vice versa, you know, just around the community enough that there would be common interest and people would come up with ideas for conferences and provide speakers and do those kinds of things. So this was pretty much in the 70s. I think I was trying to remember exactly when Women's Place started. That's kind of interesting, but I think it will be 74. Mm-hmm. And I think we got the space in the Y and actually established our phone line and some things like that in 74. So the time I'm talking about now is the 70s, particularly like 74 to 77, 78. And then, because of my persistence, I really wanted to start an abortion clinic. And so some of the women at Women's Place wanted to and some really didn't. So we formed a separate, or a subcommittee if you want, and added some other people on that to actually investigate whether it was time to really start a clinic. And so several of us went to Seattle and looked at a new abortion technique, which was called the suction technique. And it was demonstrated to us how someone who isn't a doctor could certainly do that technique. And also some of us decided we would go and survey the medical community in Missoula to see if we could find some medical people that would work with us to start a clinic. And some of us decided to see how we could raise money and how much money we'd need. So there was a small group of us who did a lot of the sort of fundamental work of getting a clinic pulled together. And I don't know, maybe it was about a 4 to 6 month period where we did that work and we met very regularly and, you know, took tasks and conferred back and forth and finally decided that, yes, we could actually open the clinic. And then we found a place for it and we built the furniture for it and we made the standing orders for it and the protocols and hired a doctor. And one of the connection points, again, was at Planned Parenthood. I had, when I first moved here, also gone and volunteered at Planned Parenthood because I was interested to see what role they might have in, you know, the whole birth control and abortion discussion. So I got to know the nurses that worked over there fairly well. And my friend Barb Burke, who graduated from sociology that first year or so that I moved here and went away to public health school, came back and became the head of Planned Parenthood. So we had another little interlocking directorate there with Planned Parenthood, where we had Barb and a couple of nurses that I knew and had some good experience with, who were also willing to join us in starting this clinic. So we had an interesting array of players that started the clinic. And then this was my first foray into alternative capitalization. So one of the ideas we had was to raise money from friends, family, whatever, as notes, that they would pay us, give us the money, and we would owe them the money back, because this was supposed to be a venture that would make money. Like, you know, not a lot of money, but at least enough to pay back. So we did cash flows and decided we needed to borrow. And I can't remember, I don't think it was, you know, it was like $10,000 or $20,000 at the most that we borrowed. And we wrote these notes, and then we did pay everybody back the notes. My mom was one, and, you know, different friends and whatever. And it was a very exciting thing to do. So we actually set up Blue Mountain Women's Clinic. And this isn't the story of Blue Mountain. I'll just say that was an outgrowth of a conversation that was at Women's Place by a subgroup. And while this was going on and there was this whole focus there, I think Women's Place itself probably was more and more focusing on the violence aspect. And I think one of the things that many of us in Missoula have talked about is allowing this kind of specialization, not everybody trying to do everything, but that different feminist groups working on particular things, but then supporting each other and using their resources and sharing what could go on. So Women's Place more and more was doing the rape, domestic violence. The birth control abortion was more and more moving then into Blue Mountain, and of course Planned Parenthood was doing some of the birth control. So there was kind of a separation or a specialization. So after Blue Mountain really got started, first year or so in there, so we were talking about 78 or 79, and I couldn't remember this when I was thinking about it. An interesting thing started happening at Women's Place, at least for me, which is a different set of people. The original set of people, a lot of them had moved on. A lot of them were students or were professionals but got other jobs or, you know, they weren't actively involved. And another set of folks came in to work there, and it became a very different style. And we can talk about this more if you want. But the style moved away from sort of a focus on education and what do I want to say? It's interesting to think about education and an approach of reaching out and working with the community around some specific issues, like, as I say, birth control and abortion, and then violence. And it became more of a alternative cultural experience, in my view. And it wasn't something that I was particularly interested in or wasn't my focus. And again, with Blue Mountain coming along and some of these other things happening, there was kind of a division among the people at Women's Place, so that the people that were more of that, know, women's culture or whatever language we want to use, persuasion, pretty much stayed at Women's Place, and the rest of us went on and did other things. So probably, I think that would have been 79. I was trying to pinpoint that. I'm not very good at doing that. There was an actual discussion of, well, I'll give you an example. To me, and I don't know if you've had this personally, but, you know, to me, when I go to meetings, I really am not interested in exhaustively spending a lot of time on how everyone is and, you know, the personal processing. I mean, occasionally I think that's good, but it's not why I go. Mm. I have many other things, and I have many other friends, so I don't try to do my social life through my organizations. Mm. But Women's Place became a place, in my opinion, where people were doing their political correctness social life, and it just wasn't something that engaged me. Mm. So I think that was part of the shift that happened there. Mm. So some of us left. The ones who kind of started it left. Mm-hmm. And other people took it up. And also, one of the things that had happened is some of the funding issues. When we first started, everybody was volunteer. Mm. But you can't really run something that way. And so I myself was very interested in getting a volunteer coordinator, and CETA money, the Comprehensive Employment and Training Administration money, became available. And so we had gotten CETA money in Austin for some of the projects I did there. So when it became available in Missoula, I immediately went, okay, let's get this money. So we got some money for Women's Place and also for the Women's Resource Center. And it was a volunteer coordination type money. so that we had someone who actually then got paid and could help get the materials and the trainings together and all that kind of thing. So that was a source of money. This was before there was any like Violence Against Women Act money or any of those kinds of things that I think Women's Place later got. So this was all, none of it was specifically money that had to do with the programming. It was more just a nonprofit getting money and to support employment and training kinds of opportunities. So again, that happened, and through all this process, Women's Place basically was a collective and made their decisions by consensus. But we did have one or two paid staff that were coordinating and making some of the sort of more detailed things happen. So after we left, then I think people more went into this direction. There became money available around domestic violence itself that they could apply for and get and, you know, do that kind of work and actually employ people a little bit differently than we were able to at that time. So that was the long answer for the first question. So you may want to get more, maybe some sub-questions in there.
Right, yeah. A few questions that come up while you were talking. One, I'd like to, you keep referring to Women's Place as a feminist institution, a feminist organization. I'd like to just have you define that a little bit more detailed and clearly as what that means for you when you say Women's Place was a feminist organization. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. I think in the early days here in Missoula, in the 70s anyway, what a lot of that meant was that it was consciously political around its understanding of power. And so feminist to me isn't about just women, it's also about oppression, and that you're aware that women are a class and they're oppressed in certain ways and power is the issue. And it's not enough just to provide services then. So even though that's important, it doesn't ask the fundamental question of why is the situation the way it is and what can you do about that situation, as well as working with each individual woman that comes to see if her life can be different. So it's a systems analysis as well as a service analysis. And because you are talking about power, then you have to face it in your own organization. And so I think feminist organizations may have slightly different power structures, but they're all power structures where there's been questions asked about them. So most feminist organizations start as kind of what I would call the everything is equal, so everyone has to be the same model, which I actually don't like, but it's a starting out place. So you sort of lowest common denominator equalize everybody, and no one should have more of anything than anyone else. So often enough, it gets into a point of okay, everybody should have an equal say in everything, or everyone should be trained to do everything, or just that. In my opinion, rather unsophisticated understanding of what value and equality is really about. But anyway, so a lot of feminist organizations are collectives and they use consensus and more or less understand the power dynamic there of trying to equalize power in those days in the 70s. And then, organizations evolve in different ways around that. But at least power is an issue that people talk about and try to figure out what to do about. And as I say, there's several different answers. But I don't think you could call something a feminist organization if it just works with women and doesn't have a power analysis, because it isn't really asking that larger question then.
Right, so a big part of a feminist organization, as you said, would be to look at the system at the roots, at the causes of how women's lives are and how they're affected, not just providing services.
Right, yeah. Right. And that you're aware that if power is the question in the larger society, you have to deal with it among yourselves.
Okay. And then when you were talking about Blue Mountain Clinic starting, I know we're not really going to focus on Blue Mountain Clinic here, but when you were talking about needing to provide or to find an abortion doctor, I was wondering what that was like and what was the atmosphere in Missoula at large as you all were trying to start up these services.
Mm-hmm. That was an interesting process. I have done a few things since I moved to Missoula that I didn't ever think I would particularly do. And one of them was like going to doctor in the community and interviewing them and seeing if they would be willing to do this. And the way we got started is, as I say, when I first came here, we challenged the abortion law. And we actually could get some doctors that were in their practice already doing some abortions. And so we had some conversation with and I'm not going to, I mean, I don't know if you want names, but like there might have been a handful of doctors that already, they wouldn't have wanted it to be publicized, but they were already trying to do abortions and were on our side in the whole pro-choice debate. So they were the ones I went and talked to first. And then when they weren't interested, I went to the next level of who else anybody knew and just talked to them about could we find someone that would be willing to work with us. And it actually turned out to be quite interesting that the people who were willing to work with us were the ER doctors, not the regular, who I originally thought might be the OBGYNs or anybody like that. Mm-hmm. In some ways, they were too set in their practice, and it was a little scary to the idea that they would go contract with this, you know, whatever we were. But the ER doctors were willing to, and a couple of them, I'll give a lot of credit to, took grief for it, because St. Pat's Hospital is not exactly wanting their ER doctors to contract with, you know, an abortion clinic. Mm-hmm. But they said, you don't have the right to control us in our other hours, and if this is what we choose to do, we choose to do it. So we had some of those, and our very first doctor actually was an interesting guy. I have this general theory, and you've heard me probably say it, that if you're on the edge of society, you're out there with everybody else who's on the edge, and a lot of times they're there for a range of reasons. Well, this guy was very good, but he had gotten, I don't know totally why, but he'd gotten in trouble with some of the hospital regs, cross-wired with them. So we tried to spend as much time as we could investigating him, because, you know, here was this guy, he was very skilled and all that, but for some reason he didn't have hospital privileges. But that was the reason he was willing to work for us. Mm. So it was one of those challenges, like, do you trust him enough and think he'll do a good enough job that you're willing to, you know? And we turned out to have a very fortunate circumstance where he was very good. But he didn't stay with us a whole long time, but he was the very first one, and probably that's because he didn't have, you know, he didn't have a regular practice. Mm. So that's what we did. We just went and interviewed doctors and asked them and looked around until we found somebody who, you know, would talk to us about it. And, you know, for most doctors, what they didn't like, and this is what they'd say, is, well, we don't want to be seen as an abortionist. Like, you know, one day a week, we wanted them to come one day a week over to where we had our clinic set up and do maybe 15 procedures. Mm. And they would get paid good money. It wasn't that, but somehow that was just not how they wanted to be known. Mm. And so we had to work around that into this other way where we got several doctors, most of them, say, were ER docs that would come, and they would come one, maybe Saturday a month. Mm. And we would rotate and whatever. So it made it harder for us to, you know, provide a kind of service that we wanted to. But we felt it was imperative to offer the service.
Mm-hmm. And could you talk more about the challenge that you did to the Montana Abortion
Control
law?
Act?
Yeah.
Sure. Well, in Texas, what we did is we challenged the law there in the Roe v. Wade case. And we didn't realize we were going to get the kind of decision we got out of Roe v. Wade. We thought we might just get a decision that was under equal protection or a states' rights decision, but we got a privacy right decision, which was a really interesting basis, and it really went broader than we thought. So basically, after the Roe v. Wade case, the premise had to be that every state had to make abortion legal. They had to follow Roe v. Wade, and they had to acknowledge there was a right to privacy. Well, Montana in 72 passed their new constitution, which acknowledged right to privacy, very upfront in it. So, of course, when we moved to Montana, we were looking through all of that and realized that they had something called the Abortion Control Act, which totally tried to restrict abortion, which was then totally against Roe v. Wade. Well, since we had just worked on the Roe v. Wade case, we contacted the ACLU and some other people here in Montana and said, well, let's just get rid of this law, because we knew it would have to go. And it just, the way it worked out, we worked with a couple of attorneys, Bob Campbell, who's a very interesting guy, and then a doctor, Armstrong, up in Kalispell, who's also a very kind of weird guy. But anyway, we were this odd coupling of these people who, you know, challenged the law and got it kicked out. And as I say it, I think it would have happened anyway, but it just so happened that we came here and knew this and, you know, pushed it forward very quickly.
So now I want to ask about something different, and that is the Take Back the Night event. Now, were you at Women's Place when Women's Place started?
I think
doing
I was
that
there.
Event? Because I'm not sure when it
right.
first happened.
I was just going to say, I tried to think of that today, too, because I was seeing the posters around town today, and I was going, I know I was there, I think, the first year, but I'm not sure very much longer. So my guess is that must have really started late 70s, very late 70s, and maybe in early 80s. But I do recall the first couple of years conversations around it, because it's probably stayed this way, but you know, some of the very early conversations were this thing about not having men, which is a tired old conversation, but it's always there. And then what kind of events, you know, how to make it safe, and how to, do you really want women to tell their story? Because this was a very, it was a question that various people would ask, is what's the purpose of that? And are you trying, what are you accomplishing? Is it education for the community? Is it the woman's catharsis of saying what she wants to say, you know, and how much of that you want to do? And so anyway, I can remember some of those early conversations about what people wanted to do. And the first few years, you know, marching in the street and, you know, really taking that assertion, you know, this is Take Back the Night, this is something. For me personally, I've lost that sense of identity with it, so I don't participate, but I think at certain points it's a very interesting psychological thing for women to think about, which is we have to have the freedom to walk and do what we want, where we want, and how do we gain that freedom? So again, the system analysis to me is what's interesting. This is a tactic, right? This is an assertion against a power structure, and you know, how do you make it the most effective? Okay. So that was of interest to me.
Yeah. Okay, then. Well, let's talk about just the growth of Women's Place in the first few years, because I know they outgrew the Y at some point, right? Mm-hmm. And they moved, Women's Place moved several times, so how did you experience the growth in those first years that you were there? And did they move while you were still involved?
Yes, but here's what happened. The Y itself moved. So we were in an old house over here on Orange Street. And we were in a little room. And then we moved with the Y over on Broadway when it moved over on Broadway. And so when I was with Women's Place, it was still there. I know they moved into a whole separate place. You know, the thing about Women's Place when I was involved with it is that because we were pretty much volunteer, we were always recruiting and training new sets of people because we used a lot of students, and people would be there for a while and then gone. And so that was one of the realities you just had to face, is that you needed, and I'm going to forget how many people were on per shift. I was trying to think about that. Do we have two people on or one person on per shift? But let's just say you needed, a week, how many slots? Like, say you needed two or three, so maybe you need 20 people a week. You know, how do you have that many people, and how many slots will people take, and how do you keep it coordinated, and, you know, all those things. So that was always a concern. And then how did you do your education as on top of just being there for your service slots? So there was always a fair number of volunteers that were required. I left before they really got a lot into the schools, but there was also coming a whole curriculum push on conflict resolution and handling violence in the schools that came from Women's Place, too. So I think when that domestic violence money, that violence against women money came along, they were able to hire more people and maybe expand a little bit that way and pay more rent. You know, we didn't have to pay rent in the Y and some things like that, so we really didn't have to worry much about fundraising. And I think it'll be interesting for you to talk to the next few folks about this, because I think one of the dilemmas that Women's Place ran into was, you know, how much can you fundraise? I mean, what can you really put on the ground and continue to build, and where does that come from? And so the more established institutions, like the Y, end up being able to get that money versus the more freestanding, independent institutions. Mm-hmm. So it's a big question. A lot of feminist organizations have come to ground on that because they're not part of the established institutions. And so unless you can figure out ways to continue to fund yourself, it's hard. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the community doesn't come through with the money you need. Mm-hmm. But I can't say that I really remember this as much, Donna. Because I always remember trying hard to get the volunteers. So, you know, I might be not remembering enough that we did grow, but my sense is that we were just always trying to get enough folks to do the thing that we wanted to do.
Yeah. So I want to ask more about that, about the training. So what was involved in training sessions for volunteers at the Women's Place? And who did the trainings, and what were you teaching?
Well, and when I was involved anyway, again, there was kind of a core group of us who did a lot of the training, and we were because of who we were, a lot of what we were doing was that basic values training. You know, that this is a power situation, that this is a dynamic that is in the culture, and it's sexist, and it's, you know, an expression of the devaluing of women. So we did a lot of this whole basic feminist analysis as part of the training. So you did that discussion. Then you were adding the, you know, how do you actually deal with someone in crisis? You know, and how do you make a good referral? So, you know, there were different levels of training. And so we did. We committed a lot. I mean, I don't remember if we asked people, but we might have asked them to commit 5 evenings of training. I can't remember, but I mean, a significant block of training. And as I say, some of it was this larger values discussion. Some of it was very specifically just technical. How do you listen to someone? You know, what are listening skills? What are ways that you deal with someone who's upset? How do you, you know, get them in a place where they can talk? How do you show empathy? You know, just some of those kinds of things. And then it's the content specific, which is, okay, where do you go if you've been raped? Okay, what do you do? You know, the law and all those kinds. So all of those were involved in the training.
So that makes me think about, well, about the law and other institutions that were in place. How did you at Women's Place and all of you at Women's Place work with these other institutions? What type of relationship did you have with the referral institutions mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. you were sending women mm-hmm. to?
Well, Peace had this group of women, you know, they're like, "Wow, who are you?" And the courts had this group of women, because there had been nothing, right? I mean, it'd just been the old way and the classic rape victim thing where people wouldn't report to the police because they'd be treated so poorly by the police, and, you know, they wouldn't want to go into court because of the kind of ways they were treated in court. It was humiliating, and they were, you know, they weren't virgins, blah, 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 blah. So we faced all of that, and so we just would go in and say, here we are, and Deshaw was the county attorney at that time, Dusty Deshaw, and because I sort of knew some of these people a little bit, several of us went in and just said, here's what we are, who's here, you know, we're going to be doing this now, here's how we're going to do it. We'd like to have any information from you. We'd like you to be part of our training. You know, you try to pull these people in to be part of your training, and, you know, so that they feel comfortable with what you're doing. And then, of course, continually with the police, because, part of the challenge of working with the criminal justice system is that, in my opinion, they're an institution of oppression. Mm-hmm. So they're the same people often enough that oppress very badly different people. So then you've got to basically make them women's friend, right? So there's a dilemma in there, but people have done a lot of work. We began it. Certainly we didn't begin to finish it. I'm sure other generations at Women's Place and then since then have really helped police and prosecutors understand, plus women going into law, themselves becoming the police and the prosecutors and whatever, has helped as well. So they begin to understand that, you know, you don't treat this the way that you've treated these other situations. You know, this is different, and you're going to have these advocates there, and you're going to have to deal with them and understand what they're saying and why, and, you know, that it's not okay to make sex jokes. You know, just all that kind of stuff that used to be around.
Right.
So you had to do a lot of education of the police and the criminal justice system itself to get some of this. But fortunately, it wasn't just in Missoula. It was happening all around the country. The feminist movement had taken on violence against women everywhere. And so books, conferences, trainings were going on. So it just percolated through. And we were fortunate in that, you know, Missoula in some ways is not Montana, right? So we were able to be part of a larger conversation that we could bring in and train and whatever, and then turn around and help that happen in some of the rest of the state. Like, you know, we could help get something started in Kalispell and some of the others by having conferences and things like that, so that conversation was larger than Missoula. But I had noted down here one of my interesting experiences was that because I was friends with a lot of the women who were in the law school when we did the pro-choice work, they went out and became county attorneys, because that's where women got their jobs. And so it turned out that my friend Peggy Tonin was the county attorney in Hamilton. And it just worked out that I was on the line the first time that we got a rape victim who ended up going through the whole process, and then I was the first rape advocate with her in the courtroom in Hamilton. So that was kind of an interesting experience, because I went with her to the police, I went with her to the hospital, and then I went with her into court to testify for her. And so that was the first time in the Montana law that someone like myself had been seated as an expert witness. And of course, the other side wasn't real thrilled with that. So this whole idea that, you know, these advocates are coming into the courtroom and can be witnesses about whether or not you believe this woman and what happened and, you know, all that kind of thing. So that was interesting. And it was really helpful, I think, to have Peggy. So I do think, you know, again, having women come into the professions who already get it, and then you can work with them to create the best possible case, has made a big difference. In fact, this is totally not to do with Women's Place, but I was just working this legislative session on some things, and I was hanging out in the Attorney General's office, and the woman who was doing a lot of the domestic violence work in the legislature for the Attorney General is a woman attorney who I got to know, and we talked. You know, and again, you're really seeing a lot of this now carried by women attorneys. So it's nice, that
yes.
part. Progress.
Good. So you mentioned the work done here in Missoula and how that you were able to then extend that to other parts of Montana. So can you talk about that? I understand there was, or maybe there still is in place, there's the Montana Coalition to Stop Violence Against Women.
Right, right. And that's been around, when did that start? Probably, well, early 80s probably. And what we did more is we did some statewide conferences and brought in speakers. But then, again, as the money became available for the actual violence work, then you got these coalitions because you could get someone paid to be the head of the coalition, and you got groups started in different parts. So Bozeman has had an organization for quite a while, and I think they were the place where the coalition got started and was located. And now I think actually it's moved to someone here in Missoula. But anyway, there were other places that got services offered and, you know, funding so that they could begin to do this kind of coalition work. But the big challenge, as you can well think of, you know, is the little towns in Montana and what happens to women that are somewhere where, you know, Thompson Falls or Two Dot or whatever, you know, and that's been the real challenge, is how to get services, much less challenge power, you know, in those places. And I know, having talked to the Domestic Violence Coalition people, that they still are working on having safe houses and things spread throughout the state. It's still pretty difficult to get the needs met of just the service part of what they're up to now.
So I want to talk a little bit more. You brought up the legislature, and so I want to talk about how what you and the others at the beginning of Women's Place, the work that you were doing there, how that has had effects today. I mean, what have been some of the changes within the system? So you mentioned, for instance, rape advocates. That was something that came out of feminism in the early and mid-70s. Are there other new structures that have been created that are still in place now that are, and maybe even policy itself?
Well, I was going to say, the thing that comes to my mind right away is just looking at the law in Montana, what was going on around consent and whether women's past sexual history can be brought in. So there was a lot of conversation at first around that, just to see if the Montana law was still very prejudicial against women, which it was, and then getting that changed, and pressuring the law school. There was a women's law caucus, and so working with them around the law to get it cleaned up so that there couldn't be, women's past sexual experience couldn't be brought in, and some of those kinds of things. So actual rewording of the Montana law has happened. Also related around domestic violence, we actually brought in the whole concept of doing something around child sexual assault and incest pretty early, because that started coming up too in the conversations that people were having, both in women's studies in the Resource Center and at Women's Place. You know, all of a sudden, it's been like this throughout my experience with feminism, is that issues just bubble up after you've dealt with one and you kind of going along, all of a sudden another one, which in some ways is the one that's been hidden. So the real hidden ones around the use of and abuse of children started coming up. So we were able to get a whole program set up to look at those questions and how to deal with them in the court, and how to deal with the children themselves, which came out of conversations that feminist organizations had around violence and education, and we got curriculum in schools. I worked on a curriculum project to get, you know, that conversation in schools with, for children and parents on how to deal with those issues. So I think overall, something that feminists have been really interested in doing, and I think have done pretty well, is to look at the specific legal language and change it, and also to look at community education and start to, you know, eat away at the structure of why these things are happening. It'll never be easy, but I think those two prongs have gone together so that rarely do you see someone just working on, oh, let's just look over here at the, you know, the specifics of the cases. There's always someone doing some education or asking questions about the fundamentals as well, which is what leads you into an interesting conversation around, once the domestic violence and the rape movement began to get money, and there began to become public funding for violence against women, other organizations began to want to come in and take that over. So a lot of the feminist-based organizations lost their money. And so I have friends who worked around the country in that movement that basically lost their feminist institutions because the established institutions, the social workers or whatever, took it over. And that's a common concern that you'll hear from a lot of feminists, which is feminism basically identifies these things for women and begins to make them visible and talk about them and make change. And as soon as it's become acceptable somewhat, the established institution, the social worker, the whatever, moves in and takes the money and does the service, but doesn't do the challenging of the system. And then, of course, there's no money to challenge the system. So, you know, the feminist education, how does it keep going? Because, you know. So that was one of the dilemmas that you'll get a chance to probably talk to Jen Gibson about, that a lot of us felt about Women's Place going away, is that even though maybe we didn't work there anymore, it was important to have a feminist organization doing the work because it challenged the system in some fundamental ways. And as that isn't true, then that aspect of it goes away.
Right. That's a very significant point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit more about community education. And I know Women's Place did make some publications, brochures, booklets, pamphlets, and so could you talk about...
Well, I just have two here. These were real early ones. That this was, again, kind of joint projects between, like, the Women's Resource Center and this one, and groups like Women's Place. This is the Montana Divorce Handbook. Because we would get calls about, I'm wanting to get divorced, what shall I do? All those kind of, and so you'd want to know, okay, well, do you need an attorney? Well, this was a way to help people make a decision whether they could represent themselves or if they needed an attorney and how to get an attorney and what are the issues. So this was, again, a publishing project that we put together where we got different groups to buy 100 copies or so of them ahead of time so we had enough money to publish it, and a group of us wrote it. So this was the kind of feminist publishing project that, that groups did. And then this one, again, was an early one that I worked on, the Missoula Birth Control Handbook. Again, a project in, when we were starting Women's Place and the clinic and other things, of saying, you know, we need more birth control information that's easy to read and made it available. So we did this kind of project. And we had a CETA position of someone who printed things. So we actually had some money to print and do feminist publishing. So that was one of the community education things that we did at that time. And my guess is Women's Place... In fact, I know Women's Place put out a couple other publications, but it was a little after I left, so someone else, I'm sure, can mention them to you. But that idea of actually having educational materials and products has always been really important because, again, that's part of your job, is to change the whole perspective and perception. You're running out.
I want to now talk about the intersection between what is commonly talked about now, race, class, and gender, and how was that part of the conversation in the mid-70s when you were starting Women's Place? Mm-hmm. What was the level of awareness around race, class, and gender, and how did you all think about that and talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, the people who started these conversations around Women's Place were all pretty political people. So these would be topics they were very aware of and would talk about. Now, some of the people who came in and volunteered and whatever might not have been as aware of them because race is a very odd thing to talk about in Missoula, Montana. It's just not operational. So we didn't spend a lot of time on it because it wasn't something that people experienced. We did talk a little bit about Native American culture and if you ended up with working in a Native American family situation, but we really didn't get that. I mean, that isn't who called us. So we didn't spend a lot of time preparing people for something that doesn't happen. And class is a funny one because, again, a lot of the women that we would be working with were what would be called working class women. I mean, class distinction isn't really heavy in Missoula. So like the woman I was the rape advocate for, lived, you know, classic, if you want to use the words, you know, working class woman, lived in a trailer court. She had no idea I had a PhD because it wasn't important. I mean, it just wasn't the issue because you were trying to relate at that fundamental woman level. And that's that old conversation about what's the most important variable. Well, my opinion, the violence movement, the point it makes is that women can relate to each other as women and overcome all those other categories. And some people don't like that analysis, but in my view, that's what the violence work lets us do. As you get into other work, it's harder. But when you're talking strictly about violence, and I found myself very interesting several times on reservations and in different settings, and that's exactly right. If you are talking about violence, you are immediately having a conversation that the other women in the room can connect to you. But if you're talking about some of the other topics, it's much harder. So I guess what I'm answering is that although we were aware of them and theoretically occasionally might talk about them, practically in our life, as a group that was trying to do what we were doing, that wasn't, they weren't really, you know, very significant. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I want to. We're getting near the end of the tape, and so I want to ask about your own view of yourself as a feminist. And maybe you could speak, you know, of how you had your own feminist consciousness awakening, and how now you see yourself as a feminist and how that's changed or not changed.
Mm-hmm. And well, I think I was very fortunate in the experiences I had of being around at the time I was, because I had a classic experience, which is that I was very involved politically with different kinds of social change movements, and could see that women inside those social change movements were not at all treated any differently than women outside, and so that men were talking about equality and blah blah, but it wasn't about women being equal. And so that whole analysis about the student movement and women basically saying, "Wait a minute, if we're talking about freedom and equality, it has to be about us just as well as people of color or Vietnamese people or whatever." So then the withdrawal from the movement and creating your own movement and talking among yourselves about what it means to be a woman and how you fit that into understanding the culture you're a part of. And so I had all of those opportunities. And I think probably the most important thing that I have learned, and again, this is sort of coming from my experience, is that when I was young, I thought the most important thing was to be smart. And that has worked for me, you know, through my life up until a certain point. Being smart, you got what you wanted, teachers left you alone, you know, you could be whatever. And therefore, since there are very few women that were qualifying in this category of being smart, I always thought, well, okay, they just aren't. You know, you just accept that experience. Well, for some reason, women aren't, and they're not in your classes, and they don't do this stuff. And, you know, so I accepted the exceptional woman category. And again, you know, it works for you. You get awards, you get money, you're treated well, blah, blah, blah. And then finally, at some point, or at least for me, you reach the point of going, you know, there's something really wrong with this. This can't be right. You know, women aren't dumb. I mean, why are there no other women in your classes? Why are you have no women professors? I mean, why are no women winning the Nobel Peace Prize? I mean, ugh. So then you begin to go, wait, I need to deconstruct this. So about the same time I was in graduate school working on those issues, along with the student movement, and, you know, so it sort of came together in a way that I could go, it's not about me being smart. It's just about the circumstance that I was able to be who I wanted to be, and most other women aren't able to do that, and why. The interesting thing about that, of course, is that I think it was very important for me, but it also didn't help me deal with a lot of other women, because they were very different than I was. So when I would go to consciousness-raising groups, I couldn't share a lot of similar experience about oppression because I didn't have it. So there are, you know, pluses and minuses about some of this. But overall, just, you know, having that core understanding suddenly that, oh my God, this is really not about me. This is about a whole other thing. And then just trying to work with it and to understand it and to say, well, you know, women's experience creates the reality, and we have to all deconstruct that reality and understand it and try to share power. And it's been a long road on that. And that's that thing that I was saying with Women's Place, where there was a shift in the perspective around power. That's the growth I've had as a feminist, is that you can't just say you're equal by saying, oh, well, everybody should just be the same. We aren't the same. So you got to understand how you share power even with difference. And, you know, how does respect for difference even come in, and how do you work with that, and how do you open up power, but don't pretend it's not there. And do silly things around saying that no one should have it, because obviously people do. And so how to have a more sophisticated understanding of those things and to build them into your institutions, but to work really hard to, you know, open up opportunity and not have a small group of people that, that really run things. I think that's always a challenge.
And so I know that you've lived in Missoula for all of this time period. And how have you seen the community at large change with their, you know, opinion, if you will, on feminism and what feminist women are doing in Missoula, have done and are doing? Have you seen
any? Well, you know, it's interesting. I think in the 70s, there was more of a kind of paying attention that women were doing a lot of things here, because we were. I mean, there was a lot of things getting started and whatever. And then I think people almost, because we were there, we just continued, almost lost sight of the fact that, yeah, there are a lot of feminists here and they're doing a lot of things. So it was almost like, you know, sort of like, well, what's happening with feminism? People didn't see it, but it was still doing all the things. It just wasn't new and different because they were there happening. And now I think, again, depending on who you talk to, people are aware of this feminist energy in this community or they're not. I think if you talk to people who are politically active, they will say, oh yeah, women are pretty strong and organized in Missoula. They may not say it specifically, feminists do A, B, and C, but you know, they're aware that that's a constituency that they have to pay attention to, that women are organized. If you do something they don't like this guy in the legislature, Shockley, made some crack about women needing, you know, if they're not smart enough to carry their restraining orders, then they deserve what they get, and all of a sudden, you know, women respond. So we're perceived as an organized power group, but whether that's seen as feminists doing the thing they're supposed to do, you know, it depends on who you talk to, I'm sure.
Okay, and I recently heard that you identified yourself as an anarchist feminist at one point. Is that still true, and could you talk about that? Because that was a big part of feminism when Women's Place was starting out. There was the Marxist feminist, you know, the liberal feminist, the radical feminist, anarchist feminist, all of these, which isn't really as much the case, I don't think, today, but it was then in the 70s. And so can you comment on that, and was that part of Women's Place at all, these different identities of feminism?
Well, let me say two things. One is, I think what happened with Reagan is that myself and many other feminists went, you know, we may not afford that conversation right now. We have to just be feminists. We have to all band together and figure out and work together and not let ourselves be split off into different groupings, because there's too much, if you will, you know, opposition from the outside. So we did have some really good conversations, and if I were pushed to say what my political philosophy is, most people don't understand what anarchist means, but yeah, I would say I'm definitely an anarchist feminist, which has a lot to do with this power analysis that I'm telling you, and has a lot to do with how you like to organize. So if you watch my life, I usually have small groups of what we call affinity relationships, which is people I like to work with, working on specific kinds of projects that tend to create institutions that challenge other institutions. That's totally an anarchist model. But I don't talk about it, because most people have a very strange idea about anarchism as something about bombs and people wearing black and weird things. But really, anarchism is about the idea that people shouldn't have power over each other, that the struggle is to have authentic relationships with people as equals and to build institutions that reinforce that potential in people. But how you do that is, you know, complicated, and there are a few examples of people who tried it, and you know, there's still some communes and things around that if you bother, you can find out have been around for numbers of years and are working quite well. But usually you don't see that in the regular media, and people aren't as aware of that. I was just talking to my acupuncturist today who's telling me about one. So it'd be fun to go visit. We were just talking about that. It'd be fun to go visit. So, I mean, there are people who are practicing that philosophy as well, but I think once the new right got more power, people became very clear that we needed to be feminists together. We started calling it pro-choice feminists, or feminists that basically believe women should make choices around their lives and not get into the divisions of what's liberal versus, you know, Marxist versus anarchist. You know, it's just like, you know, we're all in this, and we'll have to, you know, kind of work together, and maybe later on we can have this other conversation. You know, the one that was it, it didn't happen too much. I mean, a little bit with Women's Place and a little bit in other places is the whole one of the sort of separatist women's culture side. And there was some of that that happened in Montana for a while, and then it hasn't been around for a while. But that's a whole other arena of feminism that's kind of interesting to explore, which is what would it mean to create a women's culture or live inside of a women's culture, and how do you do that? And see, a critique from someone like myself is to say, well, there may be some interest there, but what do you ever do, and what do you get done, and what does it mean? You may create a nice little space for a few of you, but so what? You know, that's the sort of big critique. And then the answer to that from the other side is, but if you know, can't create this alternative space for some, then how do you have a vision for what you want to do for all? So, you know, there's some tensions there, but that it was a split that certainly has been around somewhat, not as much here, but certainly within parts of the feminist movement. Like, you know, what's the nature of your work, and what are you really doing on that side, you know, to create this alternative, you know, value system that gets, you know, incorporated. And one of my arguments is I try to put it in place like it word, you know, like you try to have, you know, understanding that there are spiritual dimensions to life, and you bring, you know, you create flowers, and you have food, and you, you know, read poetry. I mean, that you, that's part of who you are, wherever you are, not just, you know, in your own special little culture, but you bring that into whatever practice or institutions that you can be in. But it's, you know, all this is about how you make things different.
Good. So now, is there anything that you want to say that we haven't touched on yet?
I want to say the thing I've always been proud of about a lot of the work here in Missoula, and one of them is that the institutions go on. So for me, I've been involved in starting a lot of institutions, and most of them are still around. And Women's Place worked very hard to be still around, and I have no doubt that the women who made the choice to not, you know, to have to close down found that a very hard choice because they were part of an important tradition. But I really appreciate all the work, I'm sure, that they did in the soul searching about what alternatives they had, because I think it is pretty amazing that women have worked, you know, in so many ways to create these institutions and to put themselves in very hard situations to keep them. So I feel proud of the women who came, you know, after those of us who started this, because, you know, they had the hard work then of trying to maintain something and find resources for it and, you know, take it different ways that they weren't sure were going to work and whatever. So I know, having talked to Jen and those folks, when they did make that final decision to close, that was a very hard decision. And I know it's probably something that they'll think about all their lives.
Mm-hmm. And so then what do you think about when you think about the future of feminism and think about, you know, women, say, 20 years from now, and that connection with the past, present, and future of feminism? Do you have just some thoughts on that? And
well, the thing I am most aware of that I really try to figure out how to do is to spend a fair amount of my time, maybe not enough, with women that are a fair amount younger than I am. Because I think everybody has their own experience, and feminists have to be authentic to who they are, what their experience is. So I don't want received wisdom. See, that's why I'm an anarchist. I don't believe in received wisdom. I believe that people need to see other people as resources, but everyone has to create their own wisdom. So I think the more we are all working together in certain ways, you know, on projects together, and understanding why each other thinks what they think, and then trying to say, okay, that's how feminism goes forward. It's not like, oh, what people figured out in the 60s and 70s, younger people also believe and then carry forward. No, it's that, you know, we figured out some things, and then that helps inform who's ever thinking now that, you know, figures out something, and then we need to learn from each other and back and forth. So it has to be a living tradition. And I think in Missoula we're working on that. I think some places do it better than others. But I think that division between generations is a problem. And, you know, I'm just conscious of it and try to encourage any way to kind of work with that. The bra show is a good example to me, because I think for some people in my generation, that was a harder show because of certain elements that younger people didn't feel. And so you have to kind of go, well, okay, if that's not their experience, then who are you to say, no, it has to mean X? You know, so it's just, you know, I feel feminism is alive and well. I'm not worried about it the way some people are. To me, it's just going to take whatever it takes on. And become, you know, what it can in that particular historic time period, and some are more visible and more flaunting, if you will, than other times, you know. And we'll just see as it goes each time what it becomes. Okay.
Any final closing words?
No, except that, well, yes, of course. but I'm really glad that Diane and you and whoever else is doing these interviews, because you know, we talked several years about trying to get a lot of this down, because you know, Missoula's an interesting place. We've been able to do a lot here, and I think it's a combination of individuals, but also you know, circumstance and environment and just all of that and how that all came together, and that Montana itself is a, it nurtures feminism, you know? That the kinds of connections you can make here, the influence you can have, because we are a pretty self-reliant small group of people, pretty determined. We believe in freedom and equality in our own weird ways here. that when you appeal to those things, you know, people go, okay, yeah, right. You know, the frontier woman, you know, some of the traditions that we have, you know, that's something that people will still respond to. So I'm just glad that, you know, history is getting gathered, and I appreciate that you're spending your time doing it too.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sure.
So that was Judy Smith talking about the history of Women's Place and her involvement in feminism in Missoula. This is Dawn Walsh, and this interview has been for the Montana Feminist History Project.